Chapter 29. Sean Chan. Jeffrem Bornhold ignored the smell of burning houses and the bodies that lay sprawled on the dirt of the street. Bayar and a white-cloaked guard of 100 rode into the village at his heels, half the men he had with him. His legion was too scattered for his liking, with questioners having too many of the commands, but his orders had been explicit. Obey the questioners. There had been but slight resistance here. Only half a dozen dwellings gave off columns of smoke. The inn was still standing, he saw, white-plastered stone like almost every structure on Almuth Plain. Reining up before the inn, his eyes went past the prisoners his soldiers held near the village well to the long gibbet marring the village green. It was hastily made, only a long pole on uprights, but it held 30 bodies, their clothes ruffled by the breeze. There were small bodies hanging among their elders. Even Bayar stared at that in disbelief. "Muad!" he roared. A grizzled man trotted away from those holding the prisoners. Muad had fallen into the hands of dark friends once. His scarred face took even the strongest aback. "Is this your work, Muad, or the Sean Chan?"
"Neither, my lord captain."
Muad's voice was a hoarse, whispered growl, another leaving of the dark friends. He said no more. Bornhold frowned.
"Surely that lot did not do it," he said,
gesturing to the prisoners. The children did not look so neat as when he had brought them across the Taraban, but they seemed ready to parade compared with the rabble that crouched under their watchful eyes. Men in rags and bits of armor with sullen faces, remnants of the army Taraban had sent against the invaders on Toman Head. Muad hesitated, then said carefully,
"The villagers say they wore Taraboner cloaks, my lord captain. There was a big man among them, with gray eyes and a long mustache. That sounds twin to Child Irwin, and a young lad trying to hide a pretty face behind a yellow beard who fought with his left hand. Sounds almost like Child Juan, my lord captain."
"Questioners," Bornhold spat.
Irwin and Juan were among those he had had to hand over to the questioner's command. He had seen questioner tactics before, but this was the first time he had ever been faced with children's bodies.
"If my lord captain says so,"
Muad made it sound like fervent agreement.
"Cut them down," Bornhold said wearily. "Cut them down and make sure the villagers know there will be no more killing.
Unless some fool decides to be brave because his woman is watching and I have to make an example." He dismounted, eyeing the prisoners again, as Muad hurried off, calling for ladders and knives. He had more to think about than questioners' overzealousness. He wished he could stop thinking about questioners altogether.
"They do not put up much fight, my lord captain," Bayar said. "Either these Taraboners or what is left of the Domani. They snap like cornered rats, but run as soon as anything snaps back."
"Let us see how we do against the invaders, Bayar, before we look down on these men, yes?"
The prisoners' faces bore a defeated look that had been there before his men came.
"Have Muad pick one out for me."
Muad's face was enough to soften most men's resolve by itself.
"An officer, preferably. One who looks intelligent enough to tell what he has seen without embroidery, but young enough not to have yet grown a full backbone. Tell Muad to be not too gentle about it, yes? Make the fellow believe that I mean to see worse happen to him than he ever dreamed of, unless he convinces me otherwise."
He tossed his reins to one of the children and strode into the inn. The innkeeper was there, for a wonder, an obsequious, sweating man, his dirty shirt straining over his belly until the embroidered red scrollwork seemed ready to pop off. Bornhold waved the man away. He was vaguely aware of a woman and some children huddling in a doorway until the fat innkeeper shepherded them out. Bornhold pulled off his gauntlets and sat at one of the tables. He knew too little about the invaders, the strangers. That was what almost everyone called them, those who did not just babble about Arthur Hawkwing. He knew they called themselves the Sean Chan and Hylina. He had enough of the old tongue to know the latter meant those who come before, or the forerunners. They also called themselves Ryagel, those who come home, and spoke of Karina, the return. It was almost enough to make him believe the tales of Arthur Hawkwing's armies come back. No one knew where the Seanchan had come from, other than that they had landed in ships. Bornhold's requests for information from the sea folk had been met with silence. Amador did not hold the Atha'an Mier in good favor, and the attitude was returned with interest. All he knew of the Seanchan he had heard from men like those outside. Broken, beaten rabble who spoke wide-eyed and sweating, of men who came into battle riding monsters as often as horses, who fought with monsters by their sides and brought Aes Sedai to rend the earth under their enemies' feet. A sound of boots in the doorway made him put on a wolfish grin, but Byra was not accompanied by Muad. The Child of the Light who stood beside him, back braced and helmet in the crook of his arm, was Geral, who Bornhold expected to be 100 miles away. Over his armor, the young man wore a cloak of Domani cut, trimmed with blue, not the white cloak of the children. "Muad is talking to a young fellow now, my lord captain," Byra said. "Child Geral has just ridden in with a message." Bornhold waved for Geral to begin. The young man did not unbend. "The compliments of Jaqim Caradhan," he started, looking straight ahead, "who guides the Hand of the Light in—"
"I have no need of the questioner's compliments," Bornhold growled, and saw the young man's startled look. Geral was young yet. For that matter, Byar looked uncomfortable as well. "You will give me his message, yes? Not word for word unless I ask it. Simply tell me what he wants."
The child set to recite, swallowed before he began. "My lord captain, he says you are moving too many men too close to Toman Head. He says the Dark Friends on Almuth Plain must be rooted out, and you are... forgive me, lord captain. You are to turn back at once and ride toward the heart of the plain."
He stood stiffly, waiting. Bornhold studied him. The dust of the plain stained Gerald's face, as well as his cloak and his boots.
"Go and get yourself something to eat," Bornhold told him. "There should be washwater in one of these houses, if you wish it. Return to me in an hour. I will have messages for you to carry."
He waved the young man out.
"The questioners may be right, my lord captain," Byra said when Geral was gone. "There are many villages scattered on the plain, and the Dark Friends—"
Bornhold's hand, slapping the table, cut him off.
"What Dark Friends? I have seen nothing in any village he has ordered taken except farmers and craftsmen, worried that we will burn their livelihoods, and a few old women who tend the sick."
Byar's face was a study in lack of expression. He was always readier than Bornhold to see Dark Friends.
"And children, Byar? Do children here become Dark Friends?"
"The sins of the mother are visited to the 5th generation," Byar quoted, "and the sins of the father to the 10th.
But he looked uneasy. Even Byar had never killed a child.
"Has it never occurred to you, Byar, to wonder why Caradhan has taken away our banners and the cloaks of the men the questioners lead? Even the questioners themselves have put off the white. This suggests something, yes?"
"He must have his reasons, Lord Captain," Byra said slowly. "The questioners always have reasons, even when they do not tell the rest of us."
Bornhold reminded himself that Byra was a good soldier.
"Children to the north wear Tarabonner cloaks, Byar, and those to the south, Domani. I do not like what this suggests to me. There are Dark Friends here, but they are in Falma, not on the plain. When Geral rides, he will not ride alone. Messages will go to every group of the children I know how to find. I mean to take the Legion onto Toman Head, Byar, and see what the true Dark Friends, these Seanchan, are up to."
Byar looked troubled. But before he could speak, Muad appeared with one of the prisoners. The sweating young man in a battered, ornate breastplate shot frightened looks at Muad's hideous face. Bornhold drew his dagger and began trimming his nails.
He had never understood why that made some men nervous, but he used it just the same. Even his grandfatherly smile made the prisoner's dirty face pale.
Now, young man, you will tell me everything you know about these strangers, yes? If you need to think on what to say, I will send you back out with Child Maud to consider it.
The prisoner darted a wide-eyed look at Maud. Then words began to pour out of him. The long swells of the Arith Ocean made spray roll, but Doman's spread feet balanced him as he held the long tube of the looking glass to his eye and studied the large vessel that pursued them. Pursued and was slowly overtaking. The wind where spray ran was not the best or the strongest, but where the other ship smashed the swells into mountains of foam with its bluff bow, it could not have blown better. The coastline of Toman Head loomed to the east, dark cliffs and narrow strips of sand. He had not cared to take spray too far out, and now he feared he might pay for it.
"Strangers, Captain."
Yarn had the sound of sweat in his voice.
"Is it a stranger ship?"
Doman lowered the looking glass, but his eye still seemed filled by that tall, square-looking ship with its odd ribbed sails.
"Shonchan," he said, and heard Yaren groan.
He drummed his thick fingers on the rail, then told the helmsman,
"Take her closer in. That ship will not dare enter the shallow water spray can sail."
Yaren shouted commands, and crewmen ran to haul in booms as the helmsman put the tiller over, pointing the bow more toward the shoreline. Spray moved more slowly, heading so far into the wind, but Doman was sure he could reach shoal waters before the other vessel came up on him.
"Did her holds be full? She could still take shallower water than ever that great hull can."
His ship rode a little higher in the water than she had on sailing from Tanchico. A third of the cargo of fireworks he had taken on there was gone, sold in the fishing villages on Toman Head. But with the silver that flowed from the fireworks had come disturbing reports. The people spoke of visits from the tall, boxy ships of the invaders. When Shonchan's ships anchored off the coast, the villagers who drew up to defend their homes were rent by lightning from the sky, while small boats were still ferrying the invaders ashore. And the earth erupted in fire under their feet. Doman had thought he was hearing nonsense until he was shown the blackened ground, and he had seen it in too many villages to doubt any longer. Monsters fought beside the Shonchan soldiers. Not that there was ever much resistance left, the villagers said. And some even claimed that the Shonchan themselves were monsters, with heads like huge insects. In Tanchico, no one had even known what they called themselves, and the Taraboners spoke confidently of their soldiers driving the invaders into the sea. But in every coastal town it was different. The Shonchan told astonished people they must swear again oaths they had forsaken, though never deigning to explain when they had forsaken them or what the oaths meant. The young women were taken away one by one to be examined, and some were carried aboard the ships and never seen again. A few older women had also vanished, some of the guides and healers. New mayors were chosen by the Shonchan, and new councils, and any who protested the disappearances of the women, or having no voice in the choosing, might be hung, or burst suddenly into flame, or be brushed aside like yapping dogs. There was no way of telling which it would be until it was too late. And when the people had been thoroughly cowed, when they had been made to kneel and swear, bewildered, to obey the forerunners, await the return, and serve those who came home with their lives, the Shonchan sailed away, and usually never returned. Falma, it was said, was the only town they held fast. In some of the villages they had left, men and women crept back toward their former lives, to the extent of talking about electing their councils again. But most eyed the sea nervously and made pale-cheeked protests that they meant to hold to the oaths they had been made to swear, even if they did not understand them. Doman had no intention of meeting any Shonchan, if he could avoid it. He was raising the glass to see what he could make out on the nearing Shonchan decks when, with a roar, the surface of the sea broke into fountaining water and flame not 100 paces from his larboard side. Before he had even begun to gape, another column of flame split the sea on the other side. and as he was spinning to stare at that, another burst up ahead. The eruptions died as quickly as they were born, spray from them blown across the deck. Where they had been, the sea bubbled and steamed as if boiling.
We'll reach shallow water before they can close with us, Yaren said slowly.
He seemed to be trying not to look at the water roiling under clouds of mist. Doman shook his head.
Whatever they did, they can shatter us, even do I take her into the breakers.
He shivered, thinking of the flame inside the fountains of water, and his holds full of fireworks.
Fortune prick me. We might not live to drown.
He tugged at his beard and rubbed his bare upper lip, reluctant to give the order. The vessel and what it contained were all he had in the world. But finally he made himself speak.
Bring her into the wind, Yaren, and down sail. Quickly, man, quickly, before they do think we still try to escape.
As crewmen ran to lower the triangular sails, Doman turned to watch the Shonchan ship approach. Spray lost headway and pitched in the swells. The other vessel stood taller above the water than Doman's ship, with wooden towers at bow and stern. Men were in the rigging, raising those strange sails, and armored figures stood atop the towers. A longboat was put over the side and sped toward Spray under 10 oars. It carried armored shapes and, Doman frowned in surprise, 2 women crouched in the stern. The longboat thumped against Spray's hull. The first to climb up was one of the armored men, and Doman saw immediately why some of the villagers claimed the Shonchen themselves were monsters. The helmet looked very much like some monstrous insect's head, with thin red plumes like feelers. The wearer seemed to be peering out through mandibles. It was painted and gilded to increase the effect, and the rest of the man's armor was also worked with paint and gold. Overlapping plates in black and red outlined with gold covered his chest and ran down the outsides of his arms and the fronts of his thighs. Even the steel backs of his gauntlets were red and gold. Where he did not wear metal, his clothes were dark leather. The two-handed sword on his back, with its curved blade, was scabbarded and hilted in black and red leather. Then the armored figure removed his helmet and Doman stared. He was a woman. Her dark hair was cut short, and her face was hard, but there was no mistaking it. He had never heard of such a thing except among the Aiel, and Aiel were well known to be crazed. Just as disconcerting was the fact that her face did not look as different as he had expected of a Shonchan. Her eyes were blue, it was true, and her skin exceedingly fair, but he had seen both before. If this woman wore a dress, no one would look at her twice. He eyed her and revised his opinion. That cold stare and those hard cheeks would make her remarked anywhere. The other soldiers followed the woman onto the deck. Doman was relieved to see, when some of them removed their strange helmets, that they, at least, were men. Men with black eyes or brown, who could have gone unnoticed in Tanchico or Ilion. He had begun to have visions of armies of blue-eyed women with swords.
Aes Sedai with swords, he thought, remembering the sea erupting.
The Shonchan woman surveyed the ship arrogantly, then picked Doman out as captain. It had to be him or Yaren by their clothes, the way Yaren had his eyes closed and was muttering prayers under his breath, pointed to Doman, and fixed him with a stare like a spike.
Are there any women among your crew or passengers?
She spoke with a soft slurring that made her hard to understand, but there was a snap in her voice that said she was used to getting answers.
Speak up, man, if you are the captain. If not, wake that other fool and tell him to speak.
I do be captain, my lady,
Doman said cautiously. He had no idea how to address her, and he did not want to put a foot wrong.
I have no passengers, and there be no women in my crew.
He thought of the girls and women who had been carried off, and not for the first time wondered what these folk wanted with them. The 2 women dressed as women were coming up from the longboat, one drawing the other, Doman blinked, by a leash of silvery metal as she climbed aboard. The leash went from a bracelet worn by the first woman to a collar around the neck of the second. He could not tell whether it was woven or jointed. It seemed somehow to be both, but it was clearly of a piece with both bracelet and collar. The first woman gathered the leash in coils as the other came onto the deck. The collared woman wore plain dark gray and stood with her hands folded and her eyes on the planks under her feet. The other had red panels bearing forked silver lightning bolts on the breast of her blue dress and on the sides of her skirts, which ended short of the ankles of her boots. Doman eyed the women uneasily.
"Speak slowly, man," the blue-eyed woman demanded in her slurred speech.
She came across the deck to confront him, staring up at him and in some way seeming taller and larger than he.
"You are even harder to understand than the rest in this light-forsaken land, and I make no claim to be of the blood. Not yet. After Corina, I am Captain Iginen."
Doman repeated himself, trying to speak slowly, and added,
"I do be a peaceful trader, Captain. I mean no harm to you, and I have no part in your war."
He could not help eyeing the two women connected by the leash again.
"A peaceful trader," Iginen mused. "In that case, you will be free to go once you have sworn fealty again."
She noticed his glances and turned to smile at the women with the pride of ownership.
"You admire my Damani. She cost me dear. She was worth every coin. Few but nobles own a Damani, and most are property of the throne. She is strong, traitor. She could have broken your ship to splinters had I wished it so."
Doman stared at the women and the silver leash. He had connected the one wearing the lightning with the fiery fountains in the sea and assumed she was an Aes Sedai. Iginen had just set his head whirling. No one could do that too.
"She is Aes Sedai," he said disbelievingly.
He never saw the casual backhand blow coming. He staggered as her steel-backed gauntlet split his lip.
"That name is never spoken," Iginen said with a dangerous softness. "There are only the Damani, the leashed ones, and now they serve in truth as well as name."
Her eyes made ice seem warm. Doman swallowed blood and kept his hands clenched at his sides. If he had had a sword to hand, he would not have led his crew to slaughter against a dozen armored soldiers. But it was an effort to make his voice humble.
"I meant no disrespect, Captain. I know nothing of you or your ways. If I do offend, it is ignorance, no intention."
She looked at him, then said,
"You are all ignorant, Captain, but you will pay the debt of your fathers. This land was ours, and it will be ours again. With the return, it will be ours again."
Doman did not know what to say.
"Surely she can no mean that nattering about Otto Hawkwing be true."
So he kept his mouth shut.
"You will sail your vessel to Falm,"
he tried to protest, but her glare silenced him,
"where you and your ship will be examined. If you are no more than a peaceful trader, as you claim, you will be allowed to go your way when you have sworn the oaths."
"Oaths, Captain? What oaths?"
"To obey, to await, and to serve. Your ancestors should have remembered."
She gathered her people, except for a single man in plain armor, which marked him of low rank as much as the depth of his bow to Captain Iginen, and their longboat pulled away toward the larger ship. The remaining Sonchan gave no orders, only sat cross-legged on the deck and began sharpening his sword, while the crew put sail on and got underway. He seemed to have no fear at being alone, and Doman would have personally thrown overboard any crewman who raised a hand to him, for as spray made her way along the coast, the Sonchan ship followed, out in deeper water. There was a mile between the two vessels, but Doman knew there was no hope of escape, but he meant to deliver the man back to Captain Iginen as safely as if he had been cradled in his mother's arms. It was a long passage to Falma, and Doman finally persuaded the Sonchan to talk a little. A dark-eyed man in his middle years, with an old scar above his eyes and another nicking his chin, his name was Kaban, and he had nothing but contempt for anyone this side of the Arath Ocean. That gave Doman a moment's pause.
"Maybe they truly do be. No, that do be madness."
Kaban's speech had the same slur as Iginen's, but where hers was silk sliding across iron, his was leather rasping on rock. and mostly he wanted to talk about battles, drinking, and women he had known. Half the time, Doman was not certain if he were speaking of here and now, or of wherever he had come from. The man was certainly not forthcoming about anything Doman wanted to know. Once Doman had asked about the Damani. Caban reached up from where he sat in front of the helmsman and put the point of his sword to Doman's throat.
Watch what your tongue touches, or you will lose it. That's the business of the blood, not your kind, or mine.
He grinned while he said it, and as soon as he was done, he went back to sliding a stone along his heavy, curved blade. Doman touched the point of blood welling above his collar and resolved not to ask that again, at least. The closer the two vessels came to Falma, the more of the tall, square-looking Shonchen ships they passed, some under sail, but more anchored. Every one was bluff-bowed and towered, as big as anything Doman had ever seen, even among the sea folk. A few local craft, he saw, with their sharp bows and slanted sails, darted across the green swells. The sight gave him confidence that Aginan had spoken the truth about letting him go free. When spray came up on the headland where Falma stood, Doman gaped at the numbers of Shonchen ships anchored off the harbor. He tried counting them and gave up at 100, less than halfway done. He had seen as many ships in one place before, in Ilion and Tyr, and even Tanchico, but those vessels had included many smaller craft. Muttering glumly to himself, he took spray into the harbor, shepherded by her great Shonchen watchdog. Falma stood on a spit of land at the very tip of Toman Head, with nothing further west of it except the Arath Ocean. High cliffs ran to the harbor mouth on both sides, and atop one of those, where every ship running into the harbor had to pass under them, stood the towers of the watchers over the waves. A cage hung over the side of one of the towers, with a man sitting in it despondently, legs dangling through the bars.
"Who is that?" Doman asked.
Caban had finally given over sharpening his sword after Doman had begun to wonder if he meant to shave with it. The Shonchan glanced up to where Doman pointed.
"Oh, that is the first watcher. Not the one who sat in the chair when we first came, of course. Every time he dies, they choose another, and we put him in the cage."
"But why?" Doman demanded.
Caban's grin showed too many teeth.
"They watched for the wrong thing, and forgot when they should have been remembering."
Doman tore his eyes away from the Shonchan. Spray slid down the last real sea swell and into the quieter waters of the harbor.
"I do be a traitor, and it is none of my business."
Falma rose from stone docks up the slopes of the hollow that made the harbor. Doman could not decide whether the dark stone houses made up a goodly sized town or a small city. Certainly he saw no building in it to rival the smallest palace in Ilion. He guided Spray to a place at one of the docks and wondered, while the crew tied the ship fast, if the Shonchan might buy some of the fireworks in his hold.
"None of my business."
To his surprise, Aginan had herself rowed to the dock with her Damani. There was another woman wearing the bracelet this time, with the red panels and forked lightning on her dress, but the Damani was the same sad-faced woman who never looked up unless the other spoke to her. Aginan had Doman and his crew herded off the ship to sit on the dock under the eyes of a pair of her soldiers. She seemed to think no more were needed, and Doman was not about to argue with her, while others searched Spray under her direction. The Damani was part of the search. Down the dock, a thing appeared. Doman could think of no other way to describe it. A hulking creature with a leathery gray-green hide and a beak of a mouth and a wedge-shaped head. And three eyes. It lumbered along beside a man whose armor bore three painted eyes just like those of the creature. The local people, dockmen and sailors in roughly embroidered shirts and long vests to their knees, shied away as the pair passed. But no Shonchan gave them a second glance. The man with the beast seemed to be directing it with hand signals. Man and creature turned in among the buildings, leaving Doman staring and his crew muttering to themselves. The two Shonchan guards sneered at them silently.
"No, my business," Doman reminded himself.
His business was his ship. The air had a familiar smell of salt water and pitch. He shifted uneasily on the stone, hot from the sun, and wondered what the Shan-Chan were searching for. What the Damani was searching for. Wondered what that thing had been. Gulls cried, wheeling above the harbor. He thought of the sounds a caged man might make.
It is no my business.
Eventually, Eginan led the others back onto the dock. The Shan-Chan captain had something wrapped in a piece of yellow silk, Doman noted warily. Something small enough to carry in one hand, but which she held carefully in both. He got to his feet, slowly for the soldiers' sake, though their eyes held the same contempt Caban's did.
You see, Captain, I do be only a peaceful trader. Perhaps your people would care to buy some fireworks?
Perhaps, trader.
There was an air of suppressed excitement about her that made him uneasy, and her next words increased the feeling.
You will come with me.
She took two soldiers to come along, and one of them gave Doman a push to get him started. It was not a rough shove. Doman had seen farmers push a cow in the same way to make it move. Setting his teeth, he followed Eginan. The cobblestone street climbed the slope, leaving the smell of the harbor behind. The slate-roofed houses grew larger and taller as the street climbed. Surprisingly for a town held by invaders, the streets held more local people than Shan-Chan soldiers. And now and again, a curtained palanquin was borne past by bare-chested men. The fallmen seemed to be going about their business as if the Shan-Chan were not there. Or almost not there. When palanquin or soldier passed, both poor folk, with only a curling line or two worked on their dirty clothes, and the richer, with shirts, vests, and dresses covered from shoulder to waist in intricately embroidered patterns, bowed and remained bent until the Shan-Chan were gone. They did the same for Doman and his guard. Neither Eginan nor her soldiers so much as glanced at them. Doman realized with a sudden shock that some of the local people they passed wore daggers at their belts, and in a few cases, swords. He was so surprised that he spoke without thinking.
Some of them be on your side.
Eginan frowned over her shoulder at him, obviously puzzled. Without slowing, she looked at the people and nodded to herself.
You mean the swords? They are our people now, traitor. They have sworn the oaths.
She stopped abruptly, pointing at a tall, heavy-shouldered man with a heavily embroidered vest and a sword swinging on a plain leather baldric.
You.
The man halted in mid-step, one foot in the air, and a frightened look suddenly on his face. It was a hard face, but he looked as if he wanted to run. Instead, he turned to her and bowed, hands on knees, eyes fixed on her boots.
How may this one serve the captain?
He asked in a tight voice.
You are a merchant, Eginan said. You have sworn the oaths?
Yes, captain, yes.
He did not take his eyes from her feet.
What do you tell people when you take your wagons inland?
That they must obey the forerunners, captain. Await the return and serve those who come home.
And do you never think to use that sword against us?
The man's hands went white-knuckled, gripping his knees, and there was suddenly sweat in his voice.
I have sworn the oaths, Captain. I obey, await, and serve.
You see, Eginan said, turning to Doman, there's no reason to forbid them weapons. There must be trade, and merchants must protect themselves from bandits. We allow the people to come and go as they will, so long as they obey, await, and serve. Their forefathers broke their oaths, but these have learned better.
She started back up the hill, and the soldiers pushed Doman after her. He looked back at the merchant. The man stayed bent as he was, till Eginan was 10 paces up the street. Then he straightened and hurried the other way, leaping down the sloping street. Eginan and his guards did not look around either when a mounted Shan-Chan troop passed them, climbing the street. The soldiers rode creatures that looked almost like cats the size of horses, but with lizards' scales rippling bronze beneath their saddles. Clawed feet grasped the cobblestones. A three-eyed head turned to regard Doman as the troop climbed by. Aside from everything else, it seemed too knowing for Doman's peace of mind. He stumbled and almost fell. All along the street, the fallmen were pressing themselves back against the fronts of the buildings, some closing their eyes. The Shan-Chan paid them no heed. Doman understood why the Seanchan could allow the people as much freedom as they did. He wondered if he would have had enough nerve to resist. Damani, monsters. He wondered if there was anything to stop the Seanchan from marching all the way to the spine of the world.
No my business, he reminded himself roughly, and considered whether there was any way to avoid the Seanchan in his future trading.
They reached the top of the incline where the town gave way to hills. There was no town wall. Ahead were the inns that served merchants who traded inland, and wagon yards and stables. Here the houses would have made respectable manors for the minor lords in Ilion. The largest of them had an honor guard of Seanchan soldiers out front, and a blue-edged banner bearing a golden, spread-winged hawk rippling from it. Eginan surrendered her sword and dagger before taking Doman inside. Her two soldiers remained in the street. Doman began to sweat. He smelled a lord in this. It was never good to do business with a lord on the lord's own ground. In the front hall, Eginan left Doman at the door and spoke to a servant, a local man judging by the full sleeves of his shirt and the spirals embroidered across his chest. Doman believed he caught the words, High Lord. The servant hurried away, returning finally to lead them to what was surely the largest room in the house. Every stick of furniture had been cleared out of it, even the rugs, and the stone floor was polished to a bright gleam. Folding screens, painted with strange birds, hid walls and windows. Eginan stopped just inside the room. When Doman tried to ask where they were and why, she silenced him with a savage glare and a wordless growl. She did not move, but she seemed on the point of bouncing on her toes. She held whatever it was she had taken from his ship as if it were precious. He tried to imagine what it could be. Suddenly a gong sounded softly, and the Seanchan woman dropped to her knees, setting the silk-wrapped something carefully beside her. At a look from her, Doman got down as well. Lords had strange ways, and he suspected Seanchan lords might have stranger ones than he knew. Two men appeared in the doorway at the far end of the room. One had the left side of his scalp shaved, his remaining pale golden hair braided and hanging down over his ear to his shoulder. His deep yellow robe was just long enough to let the toes of yellow slippers peek out when he walked. The other wore a blue silk robe, brocaded with birds, and long enough to trail nearly a span on the floor behind him. His head was shaved bald, and his fingernails were at least an inch long, those on the first two fingers of each hand lacquered blue. Doman's mouth dropped open.
You are in the presence of the High Lord Truach, the yellow-haired man intoned, who leads those who come before and succors the return.
Eginan prostrated herself with her hands at her sides. Doman imitated her with alacrity. Even the High Lords of Tyr would not demand this, he thought. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Eginan kissing the floor. With a grimace, he decided there was a limit to imitation.
They can no see whether I do or no anyway.
Eginan suddenly stood. He started to rise as well and made it as far as one knee before a growl in her throat and a scandalized look on the face of the man with the braid put him back down, face to the floor and muttering under his breath.
I would not do this for the King of Ilion and the Council of Nine together.
Your name is Eginan?
It had to be the voice of the man in the blue robe. His slurring speech had a rhythm almost like singing.
I was so named on my sword day, High Lord, she replied humbly. This is a fine specimen, Eginan. Quite rare. Do you wish a payment?
That the High Lord is pleased is payment enough. I live to serve, High Lord.
I will mention your name to the Empress, Eginan. After the return, new names will be called to the blood. Show yourself fit, and you may shed the name Eginan for a hire.
The High Lord honors me.
Yes, you may leave.
Doman could see nothing but her boots backing out of the room, pausing at intervals for bows. The door closed behind her. There was a long silence. He was watching sweat from his forehead drip onto the floor when Truach spoke again.
You may rise, traitor.
Doman got to his feet and saw what Truach held in his long-nailed fingers. The Quendiar disc shaped into the ancient seal of the Aes Sedai. Remembering Eginan's reaction when he mentioned Aes Sedai, Doman began to sweat in earnest. There was no animosity in the High Lord's dark eyes, only a slight curiosity. But Doman did not trust lords.
Do you know what this is, traitor?
No, High Lord.
Doman's reply was as steady as a rock. No traitor lasted long who could not lie with a straight face and an easy voice.
And yet you keep it in a secret place.
I do collect old things, High Lord, from times past. There do be those who would steal such, did they lay easy to hand.
Turok regarded the black and white disc for a moment.
This is Quendiar, traitor. Do you know that name? And older than you perhaps know. Come with me.
Doman followed the man cautiously, feeling a little more sure of himself. With any lord of the lands he knew, if guards were going to be summoned, they already would have been. But the little he had seen of Shan-Chan told him they did not do things as other men did. He schooled his face to stillness. He was led into another room. He thought the furniture here had to have been brought by Turok. It seemed to be made of curves with no straight lines at all, and the wood was polished to bring out strange graining. There was one chair on a silken carpet woven in birds and flowers, and one large cabinet made in a circle. Folding screens made new walls. The man with the braid opened the doors of the cabinet to reveal shelves, holding an odd assortment of figurines, cups, bowls, vases, 50 different things, no two alike in size or shape. Doman's breath caught as Turok carefully set the disc beside its exact twin.
Quendiar,
Turok said.
That is what I collect, traitor. Only the Empress herself has a finer collection.
Doman's eyes almost popped out of his head. If everything on those shelves was truly Quendiar, it was enough to buy a kingdom, or at least to found a great house. Even a king might beggar himself to buy so much of it, if he even knew where to find so much. He put on a smile.
High Lord, please accept this piece as a gift.
He did not want to let it go, but that was better than angering this Shan-Chan. Maybe the Dark Friends will chase him now.
I do be but a simple trader. I only want to trade. Let me sail, and I do promise that—
Turok's expression never changed, but the man with the braid cut Doman off with a snapped,
Unshaven dog! You speak of giving the High Lord what Captain Aginan has already given. You bargain as if the High Lord were a merchant. You will be flayed alive over 9 days, dog, and—
The barest motion of Turok's finger silenced him.
I cannot allow you to leave me, traitor, the High Lord said. In this shadowed land of oathbreakers, I find none who can converse with a man of sensibilities. But you are a collector. Perhaps your conversation will be interesting.
He took the chair, lolling back in its curves, to study Doman. Doman put on what he hoped was an ingratiating smile.
High Lord, I do be a simple trader, a simple man. I do not have the way of talking with great lords.
The man with the braid glared at him, but Turok seemed not to hear. From behind one of the screens, a slim, pretty young woman appeared on quick feet to kneel beside the High Lord, offering a lacquered tray bearing a single cup, thin and handleless, of some steaming black liquid. Her dark, round face was vaguely reminiscent of the sea folk. Turok took the cup carefully in his long-nailed fingers, never looking at the young woman, and inhaled the fumes. Doman took one look at the girl and pulled his eyes away with a strangled gasp. Her white silk robe was embroidered with flowers, but so sheer he could see right through it, and there was nothing beneath but her own slimness.
The aroma of calf, Turok said, is almost as enjoyable as the flavor. Now, traitor, I have learned that Quendiar is even more rare here than in Shan-Chan. Tell me how a simple trader came to possess a piece.
He sipped his cough and waited. Doman took a deep breath and set about trying to lie his way out of Falma. Chapter 30 Deus de Mar. In the room shared by Huron and Loyal, Rand peered through the window at the ordered lines and terraces of Kyrian, the stone buildings and slate roofs. He could not see the Illuminator's chapter house. Even if huge towers and great lords' houses had not been in the way, the city walls would have prevented it. The Illuminators were on everyone's tongues in the city, even now, days after the night, when they had lofted only one night flower into the sky, and that early. A dozen different versions of the scandal were being told, discounting minor variations, but none close to the truth. Rand turned away. He hoped no one had been hurt in the fire, but the Illuminators had not so far admitted there had been a fire. They were a close-mouthed lot about what went on inside their chapter house.
"I will take the next watch," he told Huron, "as soon as I come back."
"There is no need, my lord."
Huron bowed as deeply as any Kyrianan.
"I can keep watch. Truly, my lord need not trouble himself."
Rand drew a deep breath and exchanged looks with Loyal. The Ogier only shrugged. The sniffer was growing more formal every day they remained in Kyrian. The Ogier simply commented that humans often acted oddly.
"Huron," Rand said, "you used to call me Lord Rand, and you used not to bow every time I looked at you."
"I want him to unbend and call me Lord Rand again," he thought with amazement.
"Lord Rand? Light, we have to get out of here before I start wanting him to bow.
Will you please sit down? You make me tired looking at you."
Huron stood with his back stiff, yet appeared ready to leap to perform any task Rand might request. He neither sat down nor relaxed now.
"It wouldn't be proper, my lord. We have to show these Kyrianen. We know how to be every bit as proper as—"
"Will you stop saying that?" Rand shouted.
"As you wish, my lord."
It was an effort for Rand not to sigh again. "Huron, I'm sorry. I should not have shouted at you."
"It's your right, my lord," Huron said simply. "If I don't do the way you want, it's your right to shout."
Rand stepped toward the sniffer with the intention of grabbing the man's collar and shaking him. A knock on the connecting door to Rand's room froze them all, but Rand was pleased to see that Huron did not wait to ask permission before picking up his sword. The Heronmark blade was at Rand's waist. Going out, he touched its hilt. He waited for Loyal to seat himself on his long bed, arranging his legs and the tails of his coat to further obscure the blanket-covered chest under the bed, then yanked open the door. The innkeeper stood there, rocking with eagerness and pushing his tray at Rand. Two sealed parchments lay on the tray.
"Forgive me, my lord," Quayle said breathlessly. "I could not wait until you came down, and then you were not in your own room, forgive me, but—"
He jiggled the tray. Rand snatched the invitations, there had been so many, without looking at them, took the innkeeper's arm and turned him toward the door to the hall.
"Thank you, Master Quayle, for taking the trouble. If you'll leave us alone now, please—" "But my lord," Quayle protested, "these are from—"
"Thank you."
Rand pushed the man into the hall and pulled the door shut firmly. He tossed the parchments onto the table.
"He hasn't done that before. Loyal, do you think he was listening at the door before he knocked?"
"You are starting to think like these Kyrianen."
The Ogier laughed, but his ears twitched thoughtfully, and he added,
"Still, he is Kyrianen, so he may well have been. I don't think we said anything he should not have heard."
Rand tried to remember. None of them had mentioned the Horn of Valir or Trollocs or Dark Friends. When he found himself wondering what Quayle could make of what they actually had said, he gave himself a shake. "This place is getting to you, too," he muttered to himself.
"My lord?"
Huron had picked up the sealed parchments and was gazing wide-eyed at the seals.
"My lord, these are from Lord Barthanis, High Seat of House Damodred, and from—"
His voice dropped with awe.
"The king."
Rand waved them away. "They still go in the fire like the rest, unopened."
"But my lord—"
"Huron," Rand said patiently, "you and Loyal between you have explained this great game to me. If I go wherever it is they've invited me, the Kyrianen will read something into it and think I am part of somebody's plot. If I don't go, they'll read something into that. If I send back an answer, they will dig for meaning in it, and the same if I don't answer. And since half of Kyrian apparently spies on the other half, everybody knows what I do. I burned the first two, and I will burn these just like all the others."
One day there had been 12 in the pile he tossed in the common room fireplace, seals unbroken.
"Whatever they make of it, at least it's the same for everybody. I am not for anyone in Kyrian, and I am not against anyone.
I have tried to tell you,
Loyal said.
I don't think it works that way. Whatever you do, Kyrianen will see some sort of plot in it. At least, that is what Elder Haman always said.
Huron held the sealed invitations out to Rand as if offering gold.
My lord, this one bears the personal seal of Goldrian. His personal seal, my lord. And this one the personal seal of Lord Barthanas, who is next to the king himself in power. My lord, burn these and you make enemies as powerful as you can find. Burning them's worked so far because the other houses are all waiting to see what you're up to, and thinking you must have powerful allies to risk insulting them. But Lord Barthanas and the king, insult them, and they'll act for sure.
Rand scrubbed his hands through his hair. What if I refuse them both?
It won't work, my lord. Every last house has sent you an invitation now. If you decline these, well, for sure at least one of the other houses will figure, if you're not allied with the king or Lord Barthanas, then they can answer your insult of burning their invitation. My lord, I hear the houses of Kyrian use killers now. A knife in the street, an arrow from a rooftop, poison slipped in your wine.
You could accept both,
Loyal suggested.
I know you don't want to, Rand, but it might even be fun. An evening at a lord's manor, or even at the royal palace. Rand, the Shinarans believed in you.
Rand grimaced. He knew it had been chance that the Shinarans thought he was a lord. A chance likeness of names, a rumor among the servants, and Moraine and the Ammerlin stirring it all. But Celine had believed it too. Maybe she'll be at one of these. Huron was shaking his head violently, though.
Builder, you don't know Deus de Mar as well as you think you do. Not the way they played in Kyrian, not now. With most houses, it wouldn't matter. Even when they're plotting against each other to the knife, they act like they aren't, out where everybody can see. But not these two. House Domodred held the throne until Laemon lost it, and they want it back. The king would crush them if they weren't nearly as powerful as he is. You can't find bitterer rivals than House Riotan and House Domodred. If my lord accepts both, both houses will know it as soon as he sends his answers, and they'll both think he's part of some plot by the other against them. They'll use the knife and the poison as quick as look at you.
And I suppose, Rand growled, if I only accept one, the other will think I'm allied with that house. Huron nodded. And they will probably try to kill me to stop whatever I'm involved in. Huron nodded again. Then do you have any suggestion as to how I avoid any of them wanting to see me dead? Huron shook his head.
I wish I'd never burned those first two. Yes, my lord. But it wouldn't have made much difference, I'm guessing. Whoever you accepted or rejected, these Kyrianen would see something in it.
Rand held out his hand, and Huron laid the two folded parchments in it. The one was sealed, not with the tree and crown of House Domodred, but with Barthanas's charging boar. The other bore Galdrian's stag. Personal seals. Apparently, he had managed to rouse interest in the highest quarters by doing nothing at all. These people are crazy, he said, trying to think of a way out of this.
Yes, my lord.
I will let them see me in the common room with these, he said slowly. Whatever was seen in the common room at midday was known in 10 houses before nightfall, and in all of them by daybreak next. I won't break the seals. That way they will know I have not answered either one yet. As long as they are waiting to see which way I jump, maybe I can earn a few more days. Ingtar has to come soon. He has to.
Now that is thinking like a Kyrianen, my lord,
Huron said, grinning. Rand gave him a sour look, then stuffed the parchments into his pocket on top of Celine's letters.
Let's go, Loyal. Maybe Ingtar has arrived.
When he and Loyal reached the common room, no man and woman in it looked at Rand. Quail was polishing a silver tray as if his life depended on its gleam. The serving girls hurried between the tables as if Rand and the Ogier did not exist. Every last person at the tables stared into his or her mug as if the secrets of power lay in wine or ale. Not one of them said a word. After a moment, he pulled the two invitations from his pocket and studied the seals, then stuck them back. Quail gave a little jump as Rand started for the door. Before it closed behind him, he heard conversation spring up again. Rand strode down the street so fast that Loyal did not have to shorten his stride to stay beside him.
We have to find a way out of the city, Loyal.
This trick with the invitations can't work more than 2 or 3 days. If Ingtar doesn't come by then, we must leave anyway.
Agreed, Loyal said.
But how?
Loyal began ticking off points on his thick fingers.
Fane is out there, or there would not have been Trollocs in the foregate. If we ride out, they will be on us as soon as we are out of sight of the city. If we travel with a merchant train, they'll certainly attack it.
No merchant would have more than 5 or 6 guards, and they would probably run as soon as they saw a Trolloc.
If only we knew how many Trollocs Fane has and how many dark friends. You have cut his numbers down.
He did not mention the Trolloc he had killed, but from his frown, his long eyebrows hanging down onto his cheeks, he was thinking of it.
It doesn't matter how many he has, Rand said. 10 are as bad as 100. If 10 Trollocs attacked us, I don't think we'd get away again.
He avoided thinking of the way he might, just might, deal with 10 Trollocs. It had not worked when he tried to help Loyal, after all.
I do not think we could either. I don't think we have money to take passage very far, but even so, if we tried to reach the Foregate docks, well, Fane must have dark friends watching. If he thought we were taking ship, I don't believe he would care who saw the Trollocs. Even if we fought free of them somehow, we would have to explain ourselves to the city guards, and they would certainly not believe we cannot open this chest, so...
We are not letting any Kyrianan see that chest, Loyal.
The Ogier nodded.
And the city docks are no good either.
The city docks were reserved for grain barges and the pleasure craft of the lords and ladies. No one came to them without permission. One could look down on them from the wall, but it was a drop that would break even Loyal's neck. Loyal wiggled his thumb as if trying to think of a point for that, too.
I suppose it is too bad we cannot reach Steading Tsofu. Trollocs would never come into a steading, but I don't suppose they would let us get that far without attacking.
Rand did not answer. They had reached the big guardhouse just inside the gate by which they had first entered Kyrian. Outside, the foregate teemed and milled, and a pair of guards kept watch on them. Rand thought a man, dressed in what had once been good Shinaran clothes, ducked back into the crowd at the sight of him, but he could not be sure. There were too many people in clothes from too many lands, all of them hurrying. He went up the steps into the guardhouse, past breastplated guards on either side of the door. The large anteroom had large wooden benches for people with business there, mainly folk waiting with a humble patience, wearing the plain dark garments that marked the poorer commoners. There were a few foregaters among them, picked out by shabbiness and bright colors, no doubt hoping for permission to seek work inside the walls. Rand went straight to the long table in the back of the room. There was only one man seated behind it, not a soldier, with one green bar across his coat. A plump fellow whose skin looked too tight, he adjusted documents on the table and shifted the position of his inkwell twice before looking up at Rand and Loyal with a false smile.
How may I help you, my lord?
The same way I hoped you could help me yesterday, Rand said, with more patience than he felt, and the day before, and the day before that. Has Lord Ingtar come?
Lord Ingtar, my lord.
Rand took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
Lord Ingtar of House Shinowa from Shinar. The same man I have asked after every day I've come here. No one of that name has entered the city, my lord.
Are you certain? Don't you need to look at your lists, at least?
My lord, the lists of foreigners who have come to Kyrian are exchanged among the guardhouses at sunrise and at sunset, and I examine them as soon as they come before me. No Shinaran lord has entered Kyrian in some time.
And the Lady Selene?
Before you ask again, I do not know her house. But I've given you her name, and I have described her to you 3 times. Isn't that enough?
The man spread his hands.
I am sorry, my lord. Not knowing her house makes it very difficult.
He had a bland look on his face. Rand wondered whether he would tell even if he knew. A movement at one of the doors behind the desk caught Rand's eye.
A man starting to step into the anteroom, then turning away hurriedly.
"Perhaps Captain Caldwin can help me," Rand told the clerk.
"Captain Caldwin, my lord?"
"I just saw him behind you."
"I am sorry, my lord. If there was a Captain Caldwin in the guardhouse, I would know."
Rand stared at him until Loyal touched his shoulder.
"Rand, I think we might as well go."
"Thank you for your help," Rand said in a tight voice. "I will return tomorrow."
"It is my pleasure to do what I may," the man said with his false smile.
Rand stalked out of the guardhouse so fast that Loyal had to hurry to catch him up in the street.
"He was lying, you know, Loyal."
He did not slow down, but rather hurried along as if he could burn away some of his frustration through physical exertion.
"Caldwin was there. He could be lying about all of it. Ingtar could already be here looking for us. I'll bet he knows who Selene is, too."
"Perhaps, Rand, Deus Damar."
"Light, I'm tired of hearing about the great game. I don't want to play it. I don't want to be any part of it."
Loyal walked beside him, saying nothing.
"I know," Rand said at last. "They think I'm a lord, and in Kyrian, even outland lords are part of the game. I wish I'd never put on this coat."
"Moraine," he thought bitterly, "she's still causing me trouble." Almost immediately, though, if reluctantly, he admitted that she could hardly be blamed for this. There had always been some reason to pretend to be what he was not. First keeping Huron's spirits up, and then trying to impress Selene. After Selene, there had not seemed to be any way out of it. His steps slowed until he came to a halt.
"When Moraine let me go, I thought things would be simple again. Even chasing after the horn, even with everything, I thought it would be simple."
"Even with Sidene inside your head?"
"Light, what I wouldn't give to have everything be simple again."
"Tavirin,"
Loyal began.
"I do not want to hear about that either."
Rand started off again as fast as before.
"All I want is to give the dagger to Matt and the horn to Ingtar."
"Then what? Go mad? Die?"
"If I die before I go mad, at least I won't hurt anybody else. But I don't want to die either. Lan can talk about sheathing the sword, but I'm a shepherd, not a warder." "If I can just not touch it," he muttered. "Maybe I can..." "Owen almost made it."
"What, Rand? I didn't hear that."
"It was nothing. I wish Ingtar would get here. And Matt and Perrin."
They walked along in silence for a time, with Rand lost in thought. Tom's nephew had lasted only 3 years by channeling only when he thought he had to. If Owen had managed to limit how often he channeled, it must be possible to not channel at all, no matter how seductive Sidene was.
"Rand,"
Loyal said,
"there's a fire up ahead."
Rand got rid of his unwelcome thoughts and looked off into the city, frowning. A thick column of black smoke billowed up above the rooftops. He could not see what lay at the base of it, but it was too close to the inn.
"Dark friends," he said, staring at the smoke. "Trollocs can't come inside the walls without being seen, but dark friends... Huron!"
He broke into a run, Loyal easily keeping pace beside him. The closer they came, the more certain it was, until they rounded the last stone-terraced corner, and there was the defender of the dragon wall, smoke pouring out of its upper windows and flames breaking through the roof. A crowd had gathered in front of the inn. Quail, shouting and jumping about, was directing men carrying furnishings out into the street. A double line of men passed inside, buckets filled with water from a well down the street, and empty buckets back out. Most of the people only stood and watched. A new gout of flame burst through the slate roof, and there was a loud, "Ah!" Rand pushed through the crowd to the innkeeper.
"Where is Huron?"
"Careful with that table," Quail shouted. "Do not scrape it."
He looked at Rand and blinked. His face was smudged with smoke.
"My lord? Who? Your manservant. I do not remember seeing you, my lord.
No doubt he went out. Do not drop those candlesticks, fool! They are silver!"
Quail danced off to harangue the men, lugging his belongings out of the inn.
"Huron wouldn't have gone out," Loyal said. "He would not have left the..."
He looked around and left it unsaid. Some of the onlookers seemed to find an ogier as interesting as the fire.
"I know,"
Rand said, and plunged into the inn. The common room hardly seemed as if the building were on fire. The double line of men stretched up the stairs, passing their buckets, and others scrambled to carry out what furniture was left. But there was no more smoke down here than if something had been burning the kitchen. As Rand pressed upstairs, it began to thicken. Coughing, he ran up the steps. The lines stopped short of the second landing, men halfway up the stairs hurling their water up into a smoke-filled hallway. Flames licking up the walls flickered red through the black smoke. One of the men grabbed Rand's arm.
You cannot go up there, my lord. It is all lost above here. Ogier, speak to him.
It was the first Rand realized that Loyal had followed him.
Go back, Loyal. I'll bring him out.
You cannot carry Huron and the chest both, Rand.
The Ogier shrugged.
Besides, I won't leave my books to burn.
Then keep low, under the smoke.
Rand dropped to his hands and knees on the stairs and scrambled up the rest of the way. There was cleaner air down near the floor, still smoky enough to make him cough, but he could breathe it. Yet even the air seemed blistering hot. He could not get enough of it through his nose. He breathed through his mouth and felt his tongue drying. Some of the water the men threw landed on him, soaking him to the skin. The coolness was only a momentary relief. The heat came right back. He crawled on determinedly, aware of Loyal behind him only from the Ogier's coughing. One wall of the hallway was almost solid flame, and the floor near it had already begun to add thin tendrils to the cloud that hung over his head. He was glad he could not see what lay above the smoke. Ominous crackling told enough. The door to Huron's room had not caught yet, but it was hot enough that he had to try twice before he could manage to push it open. The first thing to meet his eye was Huron, sprawled on the floor. Rand crawled to the sniffer and lifted him up. There was a lump on the side of his head the size of a plum. Huron opened unfocused eyes.
Lord Rand, he murmured faintly. Knock at the door. Thought it was more
His eyes rolled back in his head. Rand felt for a heartbeat and sagged with relief when he found it.
Rand!
Loyal coughed. He was beside his bed, with the covers thrown up to reveal the bare boards underneath. The chest was gone. Above the smoke, the ceiling creaked, and flaming pieces of wood fell to the floor. Rand said,
Get your books. I will take Huron. Hurry!
He started to drape the limp sniffer over his shoulders, but Loyal took Huron from him.
The books will have to burn, Rand. You can't carry him and crawl, and if you stand up, you'll never reach the stairs.
The Ogier pulled Huron up onto his broad back, arms and legs hanging to either side. The ceiling gave a loud crack.
We must hurry, Rand.
Go, Loyal. Go, and I'll follow.
The Ogier crawled into the hall with his burden, and Rand started after him. Then he stopped, staring back at the connecting door to his room. The banner was still in there. The banner of the dragon. Let it burn, he thought. And an answering thought came as if he had heard Moraine say it.
Your life may depend on it. She's still trying to use me. Your life may depend on it. Aes Sedai never lie.
With a groan, he rolled across the floor and kicked open the door to his room. The other room was a mass of flame. The bed was a bonfire, red runners already crossed the floor. There would be no crawling across that. Getting to his feet, he ran crouching into the room, flinching from the heat, coughing, choking. Steam rose from his damp coat. One side of the wardrobe was already burning. He snatched open the door. His saddlebags lay inside, still protected from the fire, one side bulging with the banner of Luz Theron Telamon, the wooden flute case beside them. For an instant he hesitated.
I could still let it burn.
The ceiling above him groaned. He grabbed saddlebags and flute case and threw himself back through the door, landing on his knees as burning timbers crashed where he had stood. Dragging his burden, he crawled into the hall. The floor shook with more falling beams. The men with the buckets were gone when he reached the stairs. He all but slid down the steps to the next landing, scrambled to his feet, and ran through the now empty building into the street. The onlookers stared at him with his face blackened and his coat covered with smut, but he staggered to where Loyal had propped Huron against the wall of a house across the street. A woman from the crowd was wiping Huron's face with a cloth, but his eyes were still closed and his breath came in heaves.
Is there a wisdom nearby? Rand demanded. He needs help.
The woman looked at him blankly, and he tried to remember the other names he had heard people call the women who would be wisdoms in the two rivers.
A wise woman. A woman you call Mother Somebody. A woman who knows herbs and healing.
I am a reader, if that is what you mean, the woman said. But all I know to do for this one is to make him comfortable. Something is broken inside his head, I fear.
Rand, it is you!
Rand stared. It was Matt, leading his horse through the crowd, with his bow strung across his back. A Matt whose face was pale and drawn, but still Matt, and grinning, if weakly. And behind him came Perrin, his yellow eyes shining in the fire and earning as many looks as the blaze. And Ingtar, dismounting in a high-collared coat instead of armor, but still with his sword hilt sticking up over his shoulder. Rand felt a shiver run through him.
It's too late, he told them. You came too late.
And he sat down in the street and began to laugh. Chapter 31. On the Scent. Rand did not know Varen was there until the Aes Sedai took his face in her hands. For a moment he could see worry in her face, perhaps even fear, and then suddenly he felt as if he had been doused with cold water. Not the wet, but the tingle. He gave one abrupt shudder and stopped laughing. She left him to crouch over Hurin. The reader watched her carefully, so did Rand.
What is she doing here?
As if I didn't know.
Where did you go? Matt demanded hoarsely. You all just disappeared, and now you're in Kyrian ahead of us. Loyal?
The Ogier shrugged uncertainly and eyed the crowd, his ears twitching. Half the people had turned from the fire to watch the newcomers. A few edged closer, trying to listen. Rand let Perrin give him a hand up.
How did you find the inn?
He glanced at Perrin, kneeling with her hands on the sniffer's head.
Her?
In a way, Perrin said. The guards at the gate wanted our names, and a fellow coming out of the guardhouse gave a jump when he heard Ingtar's name. He said he didn't know it, but he had a smile that shouted lie a mile off.
I think I know the man you mean, Rand said. He smiles that way all the time.
Varen showed him a ring, Matt put in, and whispered in his ear. He looked and sounded sick, his cheeks flushed and tight, but he managed a grin. Rand had never noticed his cheekbones before.
I couldn't hear what she said, but I didn't know whether his eyes were going to pop out of his head, or he was going to swallow his tongue first.
All of a sudden, he couldn't do enough for us. He told us you were waiting for us, and right where you were staying. Offered to guide us himself, but he really looked relieved when Varen told him no. He snorted.
Lord Rand of House Althor.
It's too long a story to explain now. Rand said. Where are Uno and the rest? We will need them.
In the foregate.
Matt frowned at him, and he went on slowly. Uno said they'd rather stay there than inside the walls. From what I can see, I'd rather be with them.
Rand, why will we need Uno? Have you found... them?
It was the moment Rand realized suddenly he had been avoiding. He took a deep breath and looked his friend in the eye.
Matt, I had the dagger and I lost it. The Dark Friends took it back.
He heard gasps from Kyrianen listening, but he did not care. They could play their great game if they wanted, but Ingtar had come, and he was finished with it at last.
They can't have gone far, though.
Ingtar had been silent, but now he stepped forward and gripped Rand's arm.
You had it, and the...
He looked around at the onlookers.
The other thing?
They took that, too. Rand said quietly. Ingtar pounded a fist into his palm and turned away. Some of the Kyrianen backed off from the look on his face.
Matt chewed his lip, then shook his head. I didn't know it was found, so it isn't as if I had lost it again.
It is just still lost. It was plain he was speaking of the dagger, not the Horn of Valir.
We'll find it again. We have two sniffers now. Perrin is one too. He followed the trail all the way to the foregate, after you vanished with Hurin and Loyal. I thought you might have just run off. Well, you know what I mean. Where did you go?
I still don't understand how you got so far ahead of us. That fellow said you have been here days. Rand glanced at Perrin. he's a sniffer? And found Perrin studying him in return. He thought Perrin muttered something. Shadow killer? I must have heard him wrong. Perrin's yellow gaze held him for a moment, seeming to hold secrets about him. Telling himself he was having fancies, I'm not mad, not yet, he pulled his eyes away. Varen was just helping a still-shaky Huron to his feet.
I feel right as goose feathers, he was saying. Still a little tired, but...
He let the words trail off, seeming to see her for the first time, to realize what had happened for the first time.
The tiredness will last a few hours, she told him. The body must strain to heal itself quickly.
The Kyrianan reader rose.
Aes Sedai, she said softly.
Varen inclined her head and the reader made a full curtsy. As quiet as they had been, the words Aes Sedai ran through the crowd in tones ranging from awe to fear to outrage. Everyone was watching now. Not even Quail gave any attention to his own burning in, and Rand thought a little caution might not be amiss after all. Do you have rooms yet? He asked. We need to talk, and we can't do it here.
A good idea, Varen said. I have stayed here before at the Great Tree. We will go there.
Loyal went to fetch the horses. The inn roof had now fallen in completely, but the stables had not been touched. And soon they were making their way through the streets, all riding except for Loyal, who claimed he had grown used to walking again. Perrin held the lead line to one of the pack horses they had brought south.
Huron, Rand said, how soon can you be ready to follow their trail again? Can you follow it? The men who hit you and started the fire left a trail, didn't they? I can follow it now, my lord, and I could smell them in the street. It won't last long, though. There weren't any Trollocs, and they didn't kill anybody. Just men, my lord. Dark friends, I suppose, but you can't always be sure of that by smell. A day, maybe, before it fades.
I don't think they can open the chest either, Rand, Loyal said. Or they would have just taken the horn. It would be much easier to take that, if they could, rather than the whole chest.
Rand nodded. They must have put it in a cart, or on a horse. Once they get it beyond the foregate, they'll join the Trollocs again for sure. You'll be able to follow that trail, Huron.
I will, my lord.
Then you must rest until you're fit, Rand told him. The sniffer looked steadier, but he rode slumped, and his face was weary. At best, they will only be a few hours ahead of us. If we ride hard... Suddenly he noticed that the others were looking at him, Varen and Ingtar, Matt and Perrin. He realized what he had been doing, and his face colored.
I am sorry, Ingtar. It's just that I've become used to being in charge, I suppose. I'm not trying to take your place.
Ingtar nodded slowly.
Moraine chose well when she made Lord Agelmar name you my second. Perhaps it would have been better if the Ammerlin seat had given you the charge.
The Shinaran barked a laugh.
At least you have actually managed to touch the horn.
After that, they rode in silence. The Great Tree could have been twin to the Defender of the Dragon Wall, a tall stone cube of a building with a common room paneled in dark wood and decorated with silver, a large polished clock on the mantel over the fireplace. The innkeeper could have been Quail's sister. Mistress Teirdre had the same slightly plump look and the same unctuous manner, and the same sharp eyes, the same air of listening to what was behind the words you spoke. But Teirdre knew Varen, and her welcoming smile for the Aes Sedai was warm. She never mentioned Aes Sedai aloud, but Rand was sure she knew. Teirdre and a swarm of servants saw to their horses and settled them in their rooms. Rand's room was as fine as the one that had burned, but he was more interested in the big copper bathtub two serving men wrestled through the door, and the steaming buckets of water scullery maids brought up from the kitchen. One look in the mirror above the washstand showed him a face that looked as if he had rubbed it with charcoal, and his coat had black smears across the red wool. He stripped off and climbed into the tub, but he thought as much as washed. Varen was there. One of three Aes Sedai that he could trust not to try to gentle him themselves, or turn him over to those who would. Or so it seemed, at least. One of three who wanted him to believe he was the dragon reborn, to use him as a false dragon. She's Moraine's eyes watching me, Moraine's hand trying to pull my strings. But I have cut the strings. His saddlebags had been brought up, and a bundle from the pack horse containing fresh clothes. He toweled off and opened the bundle and sighed. He had forgotten that both the other coats he had were as ornate as the one he had tossed on the back of a chair for a maid to clean. After a moment, he chose the black coat to suit his mood. Silver herons stood on the high collar, and silver rapids ran down his sleeves, water battered to froth against jagged rocks. Transferring things from his old coat to his new, he found the parchments. Absently, he stuffed the invitations in his pocket as he studied Celine's two letters. He wondered how he could have been such a fool. She was the beautiful young daughter of a noble house. He was a shepherd, whom Aes Sedai were trying to use, a man doomed to go mad if he did not die first. Yet he could still feel the pull of her just looking at her writing, and could almost smell the perfume of her. "I'm a shepherd," he told the letters, "not a great man. And if I could marry anyone, it would be Egwene, but she wants to be Aes Sedai. And how can I marry any woman, love any woman, when I'll go mad and maybe kill her?" Words could not lessen his memory of Celine's beauty, though, or the way she made his blood go warm just by looking at him. It almost seemed to him that she was in the room with him, that he could smell her perfume, so much so that he looked around and laughed to find himself alone. "Having fancies like I'm addled already," he muttered. Abruptly, he tipped back the mantle of the lamp on the bedside table, lit it, and thrust the letters into the flame. Outside the inn, the wind picked up to a roar, leaking in through the shutters and fanning the flames to engulf the parchment. Hurriedly, he tossed the burning letters into the cold hearth just before the fire reached his fingers. He waited until the last blackened curl went out before he buckled on his sword and left the room. Varen had taken a private dining room, where shelves along the dark walls held even more silver than those in the common room. Matt was juggling three boiled eggs and trying to appear nonchalant. Ingtar peered into the unlit fireplace, frowning. Loyal had a few books from Faldara still in his pockets and was reading one beside a lamp. Aaron slouched the table, studying his hands clasped on the tabletop. To his nose, the room smelled of beeswax used to polish the paneling. "It was him," he thought. "Rand is the Shadow Killer. Light, what's happening to all of us?" His hands tightened into fists, large and square. These hands were meant for a smith's hammer, not an axe. He glanced up as Rand entered. Perrin thought he looked determined, set on some course of action. The Aes Sedai motioned Rand to a high-backed armchair across from her. "How is Hurin?" Rand asked her, arranging his sword so he could sit. "Resting?" "He insisted on going out," Ingtar answered. "I told him to follow the trail only until he smelled Trollocs. We can follow it from there tomorrow. Or do you want to go after them tonight?" "Ingtar," Rand said uneasily, "I really wasn't trying to take command. I just didn't think." Yet not as nervously as he would have once, Perrin thought. "Shadow Killer, we're all of us changing." Ingtar did not answer, but only kept staring into the fireplace. "There are some things that interest me greatly, Rand," Varen said quietly. "One is how you vanished from Ingtar's camp without a trace. Another is how you arrived in Kyrian a week before us. That clerk was very clear on that. You would have had to fly." One of Matt's eggs hit the floor and cracked. He did not look at it, though. He was looking at Rand, and Ingtar had turned around. Loyal pretended to be reading still, but he wore a worried look, and his ears were up in hairy points. Perrin realized he was staring, too. "Well, he did not fly," he said. "I don't see any wings. Maybe he has more important things to tell us." Varen shifted her attention to him just for a moment. He managed to meet her eyes, but he was the first to look away. "Aes Sedai. Light. Why were we ever fools enough to follow an Aes Sedai?" Rand gave him a grateful look, too, and Perrin grinned at him. He was not the old Rand. He seemed to have grown into that fancy coat. It looked right on him now. But he was still the boy Perrin had grown up with. "Shadow Killer. A man the wolves hold in awe. A man who can channel." "I don't mind," Rand said, and told his tale simply. Perrin found himself gaping. Portal stones? other worlds where the land seemed to shift? Urin following the trail of where the Dark Friends would be? And a beautiful woman in distress, just like one in a Gleeman's tale. Matt gave a soft, wondering whistle. And she brought you back? By one of these stones? Rand hesitated for a second. She must have, he said. So you see, that's how he got so far ahead of you. When Fane came, Loyal and I managed to steal back the Horn of Valir in the night, and we rode on to Kyrian because I didn't think we could make it past them once they were roused. And I knew Ingtar would keep coming south after them and reach Kyrian eventually. Shadow Killer. Rand looked at him, eyes narrowing, and Perrin realized he had spoken the name aloud. Apparently not loud enough for anyone else to hear, though. No one else glanced at him. He found himself wanting to tell Rand about the wolves. I know about you. It's only fair you know my secret, too. But Varen was there. He could not say it in front of her.
Interesting, the Aes Sedai said, a thoughtful expression on her face. I would very much like to meet this girl, if she can use a portal stone. Even that name is not very widely known.
She gave herself a shake.
Well, that is for another time. A tall girl should not be difficult to find in Kyrianan houses. Ah, here is our meal.
Perrin smelled lamb even before Mistress Teardra led in a procession bearing trays of food. His mouth watered more for that than for the peas and squash, the carrots and cabbage that came with it, or the hot crusty rolls. He still found vegetables tasty, but sometimes, of late, he dreamed of red meat. Not even cooked, usually. It was disconcerting to find himself thinking that the nicely pink slices of lamb that the innkeeper carved were too well done. He firmly took helpings of everything, and two of the lamb. It was a quiet meal with everyone concentrating on his own thoughts. Perrin found it painful to watch Matt eat. Matt's appetite was as healthy as ever, despite the feverish flush to his face, and the way he shoveled food into his mouth made it look like his last meal before dying. Perrin kept his eyes on his plate as much as possible, and wished they had never left Emmons Field. After the maids cleared the table and left again, Varen insisted they remain together until Huron returned.
He may bring word that will mean we must move at once.
Matt returned to his juggling and Loyal to his reading. Rand asked the innkeeper if there were any more books, and she brought him the travels of J.N. Farstrider. Perrin liked that one, too, with its stories of adventures among the sea folk and journeys to the lands beyond the Aiel Waste, where silk came from. He did not feel like reading, though, so he set up a stones board on the table with Ingtar. The Shinaran played with a slashing, daring style. Perrin had always played doggedly, giving ground reluctantly. But he found himself placing the stones with as much recklessness as Ingtar. Most of the games ended in a draw, but he managed to win as many as Ingtar did. The Shinaran was eyeing him with a new respect by early evening when the sniffer returned. Urin's grin was at the same time triumphant and perplexed.
I found them, Lord Ingtar, Lord Rand. I tracked them to their lair.
Lair? Ingtar said sharply.
You mean they're hiding somewhere close by? Aye, Lord Ingtar. The ones who took the horn, I followed straight there. And there was Trolloc scent all around the place, though sneaking as if they didn't dare be seen even there. And no wonder.
The sniffer took a deep breath.
It's the great manor Lord Barthanas just finished building. Lord Barthanas, Ingtar exclaimed. But he's...
There are dark friends among the high as well as the low, Varen said smoothly. The mighty give their souls to the shadow as often as the weak.
Ingtar scowled as he did not want to think of that.
There's guards, Huron went on. We'll not get in with 20 men, not and get out again. 100 could do it, but 2 would be better. That's what I think, my lord.
What about the king? Matt demanded. If Barthanas is a dark friend, the king will help us.
I am quite sure, Varen said dryly, that Galdrian and Riotin would move against Barthanas Damondred on the rumor that Barthanas is a dark friend, and glad of the excuse. I am also quite sure Galdrian would never let the Horn of Valir out of his grasp once he had it. he would bring it out on feast days to show the people and tell them how great and mighty Kyrian is, and no one would ever see it else.
Perrin blinked with shock.
But the Horn of Valir has to be there when the last battle is fought. He couldn't just keep it.
I know little of Kyrianen, Ingtar told him, but I've heard enough of Galdrian. He would feast us and thank us for the glory we had brought to Kyrian. He would stuff our pockets with gold and heap honors on our heads. And if we tried to leave with the horn, he'd cut our honored heads off without pausing to take a breath.
Perrin ran a hand through his hair. The more he found out about kings, the less he liked them.
What about the dagger? Matt asked diffidently. He wouldn't want that, would he?
Ingtar glared at him, and he shifted uncomfortably.
I know the horn is important, but I'm not going to be fighting in the last battle. That dagger...
Varen rested her hands on the arms of her chair.
Galdrian shall not have it either. What we need is some way inside Barthanas's manor house. If we can only find the horn, we may also find a way to take it back. Yes, Matt, and the dagger. Once it is known that an Aes Sedai is in the city... Well, I usually avoid these things, but if I let slip to Teardra that I would like to see Barthanas's new manor, I should have an invitation in a day or two. It should not be difficult to bring at least some of the rest of you. What is it, Hirin?
The sniffer had been rocking anxiously on his heels from the moment she mentioned an invitation.
Lord Rand already has one, from Lord Barthanas.
Perrin stared at Rand, and he was not the only one. Rand pulled two sealed parchments from his coat pocket and handed them to the Aes Sedai without a word. Ingtar came to look wonderingly over her shoulder at the seals.
Barthanas and Galdrian? Rand, how did you come by these? What have you been doing?
Nothing, Rand said. I haven't done anything. They just sent them to me.
Ingtar let out a long breath. Matt's mouth was hanging open.
Well, they did just send them. Rand said quietly.
There was a dignity to him that Perrin did not remember. Rand was looking at the Aes Sedai and the Shinaran lord as equals. Perrin shook his head.
You are fitting that coat. We're all changing.
Lord Rand burned all the rest, Hirin said. Every day they came, and every day he burned them. Until these, of course. Every day from mightier houses.
He sounded proud.
The wheel of time weaves us all into the pattern as it wills, Varen said, looking at the parchments. But sometimes it provides what we need before we know we need it.
Casually, she crumpled the king's invitation and tossed it into the fireplace where it lay white on the cold logs. Breaking the other seal with her thumb, she read.
Yes, yes, this will do very well.
How can I go? Rand asked her. They will know I'm no lord. I'm a shepherd and a farmer.
Ingtar looked skeptical.
I am, Ingtar. I told you I am.
Ingtar shrugged. He still did not look convinced. Hurin stared at Rand with flat disbelief.
Burn me, Perrin thought. If I didn't know him, I wouldn't believe it either.
Matt was watching Rand with his head tilted, frowning as if looking at something he had never seen before.
He sees it too now.
You can do it, Rand, Perrin said. You can.
It will help, Varen said, if you don't tell everyone what you are not. People see what they expect to see. Beyond that, look them in the eye and speak firmly. The way you have been talking to me, she added dryly.
And Rand's cheeks colored, but he did not drop his eyes.
It doesn't matter what you say. They will attribute anything out of place to your being an outlander. It will also help if you remember the way you behaved before the Amarlin. If you are that arrogant, they will believe you are a lord if you wear rags.
Matt snickered.
Rand threw up his hands. All right, I'll do it. But I still think they will know 5 minutes after I open my mouth. When?
Barthanas has asked you for 5 different dates, and 1 is tomorrow night.
Tomorrow? Ingtar exploded. The horn could be 50 miles downriver by tomorrow night, or...
Varen cut him off.
Uno and your soldiers can watch the manor. If they try to take the horn anywhere, we can easily follow, and perhaps retrieve it more easily than from inside Barthanas's walls.
Perhaps so,
Ingtar agreed grudgingly. I just do not like to wait, now that the horn is almost in my hands. I will have it. I must. I must.
Hurin stared at him.
But Lord Ingtar, that isn't the way. What happens, happens, and what is meant to be will.
Ingtar's glare cut him off, though he still muttered under his breath.
It isn't the way. Talking of must.
Ingtar turned back to Varen stiffly.
Varen said I. Karienin are very strict in their protocol. If Rand does not send a reply, Barthanis may be so insulted he will not let us in, even with that parchment in our hands. But if Rand does, well, Fane at least knows him. We could be warning them to set a trap.
We will surprise them. Her brief smile was not pleasant. But I think Barthanis will want to see Rand in any case. Dark friend or not, I doubt he has given up plots against the throne. Rand, he says you took an interest in one of the king's projects, but he didn't say what. What does he mean?
I don't know, Rand said slowly. I haven't done anything at all since I arrived.
Wait. Maybe he means the statue. We came through a village where they were digging up a huge statue. From the Age of Legends, they said. The king means to move it to Kyrian, though I don't know how he can move something that big. But all I did was ask what it was.
We passed it in the day and did not stop to ask questions.
Varen let the invitation fall in her lap.
Not a wise thing for Galdrian to do, perhaps, unearthing that. Not that there is any real danger, but it is never wise for those who don't know what they are doing to meddle with things from the Age of Legends.
What is it? Rand asked.
A Sa'angreal.
She sounded as if it were really not very important, but Perrin suddenly had the feeling the two of them had entered a private conversation, saying things no one else could hear.
One of a pair. The two largest ever made, that we know of. And an odd pair as well. One still buried on Tremulking can only be used by a woman. This one can only be used by a man. They were made during the War of the Powers to be a weapon. But if there is anything to be thankful for in the end of that age, or the breaking of the world, it is that the end came before they could be used. Together, they might well be powerful enough to break the world again, perhaps even worse than the first breaking.
Perrin's hands tightened to knots. He avoided looking directly at Rand, but even from the corner of his eye, he could see a whiteness around Rand's mouth. He thought Rand might be afraid, and he did not blame him a bit. Ingtar looked shaken, as well he might.
That thing should be buried again, and as deeply as they can pile dirt and stone. What would have happened if Loghain had found it? Or any wretched man who can channel, let alone one claiming he's the dragon reborn. Beren Sedai, you must warn Galdrian what he's doing.
What? Oh, there is no need for that, I think. The two must be used in unison to handle enough of the one power to break the world. That was the way in the Age of Legends. A man and a woman working together were always 10 times as strong as they were apart. And what Aes Sedai today would aid a man in channeling? One by itself is powerful enough, but I can think of a few women strong enough to survive the flow through the one on Tremulking. The Amarlin, of course, Moraine, and Elida. Perhaps one or two others. And 3 still in training. As for Loghain, it would have taken all his strength simply to keep from being burned to a cinder, with nothing left for doing anything. No, Ingtar, I don't think you need worry. At least not until the real dragon reborn proclaims himself. And then we will all have enough to worry about as it is. Let us worry now about what we shall do when we are inside Barthanas's manor.
She was talking to Rand. Perrin knew it, and from the queasy look in Matt's eye, he did too. Even Loyal shifted nervously in his chair.
Oh, light, Rand, Perrin thought. Light, don't let her use you.
Rand's hands were pressing the tabletop so hard that his knuckles were white, but his voice was steady. His eyes never left the Aes Sedai.
First we have to take back the horn and the dagger. And then it is done, Varen. Then it is done.
Watching Varen smile, small and mysterious, Perrin felt a chill. He did not think Rand knew half what he thought he did. Not half.